what in the world does business have to do with history, especially when our topic is business history lessons? Well, you're about to find out. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Good to be back with you. And also good to welcome back my guest this evening, Dr. Brennan Purcell from DeSales University. He's a professor and consultant who teaches and researches history and business. Welcome back, Brennan.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to see you.
Nice to be back.
Dr. Purcell started off, before he was a doctor, with a bachelor in history from Stanford University with departmental honors. Then he pursued a PhD, and he earned that at Harvard University. And that was in history also. And then what's unusual to me, Brennan, at DeSales, you earned the MBA after you had the PhD.
Yeah, call it a pivot. That's a nice
a
term
pivot.
For you. Hey, you know, it's, I mean, why should we stop learning?
That's right.
Right? And, why should
and
we stop learning?
And it was in a different area of learning.
It was very different, but at the same time, as I went through it, I began to see the connection stronger and stronger between the two.
So we're talking about business history lessons. And when Dr. Purcell was with us before, we explored topics like what is the origin and purpose of banks? Why learn about business history in the first place? Where did money come from? Stocks and bonds and all this great area of history and business history. So by way of a recap, why should people in business pay attention to history, Brennan?
Right. So maybe it's kind of too obvious to say that good business decisions should be based on data. Well, data in Latin literally means things given, things having been given, things in the past. We don't know the future. In business, you're always trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next quarter and the next year. You're always trying to make plans, but then you also have to put those plans, lead those plans, put them into effect and control the results, but you also look back. So the only thing you have is history. And why should business people pay attention to history? Because we should, none of us are truly original, right? Or more like, have you heard this great phrase, we're all born originals, but somehow we end up dying carbon copies?
No.
Oh, but wait a minute. No one does carbon copies anymore. I've just dated myself.
Yes.
Anyway, people in business and business institutions follow others in the way they behave. And all of us can learn from other examples. All people and all institutions can learn from other examples
we
in the past.
We stand on many shoulders, don't we?
We do indeed. Yeah. So let's give a nod to them and lift a hat and learn a thing or two. It was really interesting. A summer or two ago, I was at the Academy of Management conference that they have down in Philadelphia, and they take over the conference center. And it goes over multiple blocks.
That is a huge building.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. The convention center, excuse me. Yeah. And it was so interesting. I went to this special panel with a bunch of PhDs and business professors, and they were all in despair. They're all saying, and the issue is, how do we get more people in business to listen to us? And among historians, it's just kind of a given that no one's really interested except for those few historians who kind of publish really popular books, and they're a tiny number. But business professionals, scholars of business, despair in the same way. They say, we wish people in business would listen to our research because we think we've learned good, useful things for them. So that's your answer to that one. Why should they pay attention to history? Because there's good examples to be learned, and it can help us. It can help people in their businesses now make that quarter, make those goals and get those targets and perform better.
I think that in the U.S. we tend to neglect history, or we don't see the importance of it because we're a very forward-looking people. And that's a strength of ours.
I'd agree with that.
But at the same time, what you're saying, you learn from the past, you have good examples, you know what you shouldn't do and what you can do to make things better. So I'm right on the same wavelength as you are with the history.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of interesting that we as Americans, if we can talk about this culturally collectively, we do tend to look forward. And we do, I don't want to say we have short memories, but we do tend to let things go in the past. That's not true universally across the world. You find many peoples in many places holding to things that have long, long roots, and sometimes it's with a negative outcome. But that's probably a different topic.
Well, we're a very practical people too. And so we want to see something done that's concrete,
right,
that gets results.
Yes.
Preferably in this coming quarter.
Yes.
Not in this coming decade.
Right.
So we're impatient. And so this all sort of feeds into why study history.
That's right. And when things go well, put it on the pedestal. And when things go badly, put it in a box and put it away and get on with it.
So you gave me a list of 8 problems of do's and don'ts for small and new businesses. These are research or history-based business lessons that are relevant for many business owners and entrepreneurs in the Lehigh Valley. What is the Even Steven problem?
Okay, here we go. All right, so we have the 8 kind of problems. They're all, and they have a do and don't side to them. And they're just really practical. They're really, really practical. Even Steven. All right, so, you know, two people get together and they're going to start a business and they're best partners and they're best buddies and they're so we're going to do everything 50-50. I mean, everything. And, well, you know how it is in a marriage, and I think most of us experience this, that in biblical terms, man and wife are one flesh, but why is it are we not one mind? You know, I mean, yes. It's just inevitable that conflicts and different points of view will come up, and then maybe over time, different work rhythms will come up. And one member of that partner, of that dynamic duo, they're in there every weekend, and they're in there at 7 in the morning. They don't leave till 7 at night. And the other one, you know, would rather hang out with his kids on the weekend or go home at 5 or even 4:30 some days, and sometimes doesn't amble into the office till 9:30. It's kind of inevitable. And it's even worse if you have three musketeers. I almost said three little pigs. That's the wrong direction. or like the Fantastic Four, where people like split it 4 ways or 3 ways. You know, at a certain point, consensus in the face of conflict will break down. So that's the don't. You don't want to set it up. You don't want to set up your new venture with 50-50 or straight equal 3 parts or 4 parts. You don't want to do that. You need a leader. You just do. So the do side of it is you got to pick someone who's 51 over the 49. You got to pick someone who's the 34 and the other two get 33. And that way you give that person a little title. And so that way, you know, when push comes to shove, that person can say, okay, you know what? I disagree with you. And we disagree on this, but we have to move on. So we're just going to do this. So I think it's really important to have a leader, someone who is ultimately carries that mantle of responsibility for the success or failure of the business.
Sort of like in politics, a mayor of a city has to take the reins and decide what they're going to do, the governor of the state, to have one person at the head. And yet we love democracy. We don't want that person to be the only one putting in ideas.
We do. And there needs to be a good discussion going on. But yeah, at a certain point, yeah, famous lines like the buck stops here, or in the home front, ask your mother. Or right? There's gonna be a decision maker at some point, and then there's the people working in the business. Once they realize paralysis can be achieved by playing off partner B against partner A, some people will use it. Again, with the family, some kids know how to play that game. So anyway, it's just best to avoid the even Steven and just settle, all right, who and have that tough conversation up front. Who's going to have 1% more and where will the buck stop?
Would you divide responsibilities perhaps at that point as you're starting the business and say, well, you take care of the books and I'll take care of the distribution, whatever the areas might be?
Oh, absolutely. And that depends entirely on the talents and on the proclivities of those people. But you know, in terms of share of ownership of the business and just decision-making power, it can be irrespective of what those duties are. Maybe someone's more into the tech side. Maybe someone's more into the marketing and the show side of it, and the present, getting out there. But decisions have to be mutual, but there's got to be a place where the buck stops.
This is practically inevitable that you're going to have people with different abilities,
yes,
and different desires to yeah, do the work and,
yeah,
and so on. As a high school student, I worked at a small print shop because I was involved with the high school newspaper.
What do you remember about it?
I would go over to the print shop, and I remember that somebody told me there, one of the people in the office who were professionals, told me that there were two bosses. One of them had never worked in the shop.
Uh-huh.
And he would go out and he would get a proposal for a 4 color, and we need 50,000 of those,
mm-hmm,
2 weeks from now.
Right.
And he would promise it.
Mr. Sales.
Mr. Exactly.
He promised
and then
everything.
He would come back, and the man who was his partner
oh, no.
had worked in the shop,
yes.
and he knew this was impossible.
Oh.
So there's an example of trying to get together
yeah.
and figure out
yeah.
what you can do.
That's a classic disconnect, and they'll have to sort it out.
What is the oversized customer problem?
Okay, the oversized customer problem. All right, say you're running a small business, and say you're doing something with machining tools or machining parts, doing something like that, and you're getting along, you're all right. Well, a big-time company comes to you and says, ah, our supplier's dropped out. Can you do this huge order for us, like, right now over the weekend? So you get all your people together, and you all agree, all right, we're just going to go gangbusters for the weekend. And you win that account. You win that job. And then you keep that customer. And that customer just brings you more and more, and pretty soon you're working more than ever, and you're making three times your money, and the bank, your relationship with the bank has changed, and they say, oh yeah, you wanted new equipment? We can finance you. We'd love to finance you. Oh, and you're growing? We'd love to give you money to get that second building. You might be thinking you're a great success. Well, no, this is an accident waiting to happen. Why? Because that big customer out of the blue might come to you and say, it's been great, but we found an offshore supplier who costs one-third of what you do. Or they could say, all right, big problem. We're downsizing, and we have a union contract, and our extra people, the people we can't lay off, well, we're going to lease some equipment and have them do what you've done for us. Thank you very much. Goodbye. I mean, and then what are you stuck with? Your biggest customer, I don't know, what 40, 50, 60, 70% of your whole business goes away, but you're left with the break-even. You're left with the payments on that new equipment. You're left with the payments for the new building, all that. Don't get into this mess. And so that's the don't. Now, what's the do? The do is, oh, all right, you're going gangbusters. You're supplying this big customer. You're growing like crazy. But you need to take that time out of the week, not to work in the business, but work on it and think purely strategically and say, you know what? I'm exposed. I need to build out another side of my business. I need to get other customers. I can't be dependent so much on one customer. Yes, it's going better and better, but it's the situation is more and more tenuous. And should you have bought that new equipment? Should you have bought that building? What about just renting that new equipment or maybe leasing that building? There's all sorts of ways to avoid this situation. But a lot of people are so caught up in the work and in the success, they forget about that. So the oversized customer is actually, it's great. It can be great, but it can also be a terrible problem. Happens all the time.
You suggest something that reminds me of the visionary versus the day-to-day worker. So some people have a really, I don't know if it's inborn, mm-hmm. but a talent for looking at the big picture
mm-hmm. yes.
and deciding, well, where are we going to be 5 years from now?
Right.
And how is this thing going to develop mm-hmm. over the years? Whereas other people see sort of week to week.
Mm-hmm.
These are my tasks. I have to get this done by the weekend.
Right.
So that's an example of different talents, different.
Yeah, and a lot of that can be broken down into the job, right? Because the bookkeeper is the person who really has to look at every single transaction. But especially those who are leading the business and owning the business, if they find themselves caught up in the work of it and executing and doing this and doing everything involved, they really do need to give themselves a scenario. Maybe they should leave the office, go for a walk, go to your favorite cafe, just at a certain time, once every week, once every 2 weeks, to say, now I'm going to think purely strategically. I'm not going to work in the business doing its mechanics. I'm going to work on it. Am I headed where I want to head? And even if that may not be your natural proclivity, that's something everyone should force themselves to do. And this also applies to, I keep bringing it back to families and homes, but the home economic sphere. We get so caught up in getting what we need to do. Do people take out the time to say, is this really where we want to be heading? Or should we be where we are now financially? And where do we want to get in the next couple of years? So, yeah, I agree with you totally on that one, John.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce. Working the board for us, Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations. And my guest this evening is Dr. Brennan Purcell from DeSales University. His two interests intertwined, believe it or not, history and business. Well, our next question, Brennan, is what is the priced to die problem?
The priced to die problem. Okay. All right, we have to do a bit of accounting.
Uh-oh.
No. This is great. No, accounting is great. It's so, it makes so much sense. All right, your gross margin is your friend. What's the gross margin? The gross margin is basically, call it revenues, all the results of all your sales, all income you could call it, but let's say revenues, all the money coming in, and then you take away, you subtract the cost, the actual costs to supply those goods or to provide those services. It's called cost of goods sold, but it applies to services. So you have all the sales and then those direct costs for supplying those goods. What's left over is called the gross margin. And then from that, you deduct the expenses and the overhead and the rent and the utilities and the this and the that and the legal costs and benefits and yada, yada, yada. And then you're left with your net income. Gross margin is your friend. And so price to die. Sometimes there'll be a new venture, a small business that says, okay, we're going to have the best product at the lowest price. You're dead. You're dead in the water. No, gross margin is your friend. You should never try. You should never try to offer a better product at a lower price. Price to market is basically the line here. Find out what the going market price is. If you really want to sell on better quality, then what you want to do is set your price not to undercut the biggest competitor, but you know to get that price going at the market. Because you really want, you want a good, healthy gross margin. Let's talk about a couple of these things.
A question here. The term gross margin, could that be either in the black or in the red?
If it's in the red, you're dead. That means even the cost of providing your goods and services, you're losing money. That means you are on the very quick path to death. You want a nice, wide gross margin to show that, you know, you have to cover the costs to provide those goods and services with enough left over to handle all the little expenses, all the overhead, all the costs of just running a business. And there are many, many of them. So let's give you an example of just what I talked about. Say you want to open a new hot dog business and you want to make the best hot dog around. I mean, to like challenge the competition that claims to have the best hot dog in the world, right? You're smiling. We know who we're talking about. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So, but what you don't want to do is price that hot dog to undercut the gasoline stations. Have you seen those things, those kind of racks where the hot dogs are kind of there rolling away?
Rolling along.
They're all day long and they're nice and greasy. And right? That's one price. But you don't want to price to that. It would be akin to saying, all right, I want to open a bookstore. I'm going to take on Amazon with their pricing. That's a different thing. That's like it's similar, but you're taking on a gigantic competitor that can just kill you on pricing because of the volume of what they're doing. You don't want to do that. You really want to price to market because the gross margin is your friend.
On that note, we must take a first break. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking about history lessons in business. And my guest, Dr. Brennan Purcell, will be back with us in just 60 seconds.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
We're talking about do's and don'ts for small and new businesses. And we have talked about the Even Steven problem, the oversized customer problem, priced to die problem. This is Dr. Brennan Purcell from DeSales University, who is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Brennan, for new businesses in particular, what is involved in the poor planning problem? That sounds like a biggie.
Well, it is. It's kind of like a three-headed monster. Poor planning. we're Americans. We like being positive. We like being optimistic. We don't like to dwell on the downsides. But if you're a new venture, or if you're a small business and you want to do something new, and that involves a capital investment, that involves getting some money together and putting it out, history shows that like 90% of the time, you're not going to make your first year revenues, your total sales, all the money that comes in, and your gross margins. You're just not going to make your target. Problems happen, or this customer doesn't work, or this production didn't work, or these service providers failed, we had to redo it. It's kind of like Murphy's Law. It just is that way. There's three parts to the poor planning problem, and part A is there's not enough capital, not enough money put into it. You really shouldn't do a new venture or a new business or a new direction if you can't come up with more money, with more capital than you think you'll need. You need to have the pad. And don't think that capital counts as all sources of the stuff, because there's venture capitalists that support new ventures, but there's also vulture capitalists. And these people are awful, and they will send you things in the mail, and they'll send you emails, and they'll have legions of young people calling you up and say, we'd love to give you a business loan of this amount. We've looked into you, and you look great. Funny how they don't discuss terms. Sometimes they'll like send you a check in the mail, say, just deposit this. And if God help you, if you do, they will grab a portion of your business, and they can be real sharks. So not enough capital is part A.
Is there any rule of thumb for a small business how much money you would need to have right up front before you start?
Like the 2-for-1 rule, something like that.
Yes.
I can't think of one, but you will need more than you're planning for, because planning tends to be over-optimistic. It just does. And it just really helps to have capital reserves. However, we tend to pay a lot of attention to those great victors. And you know about Elon Musk. You know about Elon Musk, that great American entrepreneur, billionaire out there in California. He's the guy who runs SpaceX. And they're you know, they do these great stunts of shooting up rockets and having them come back and land in the same spot. Or they landed on a barge. He's also owner of Tesla. He started off, one of his early successes was PayPal. And he was talking about, yeah, in order to get customers, we gave everyone 10 free bucks if they opened an account. And he said, I had 16 credit cards. I was maxed out on all of them. No banks would give me anything more. This guy leveraged himself to fantastic success. We pay attention to those few who just pour in everything, but it's the 80-20 rule. At least 80% of all new businesses and all new products, they fail.
Wow.
Oh, it's terrible. Mm. The results are terrible.
Now, is that failing within the first year necessarily?
I don't know. But failure tends to come rather quickly. I'd say the first couple of years at least. Because we tend to look at the great success stories, we tend to ignore the reality that Murphy's Law tends to hold more often than it doesn't. Elon Musk is a great exception. All right, let's go on to the second part of poor planning, and it's related to it. We lay out budgets, we plan this, it looks great, and this will happen. Now you need to do forecasting for different scenarios, downside scenarios. And this is where we really have to get negative. We have to, you know, conjure up the gray clouds and the tornadoes and the random terrible events that ruin everything. You really have to do it. There's not enough of that going on. Imagine a certain number of the workforce. Imagine turnover in your workforce. Imagine the equipment going bad. Imagine disappointed customers. Imagine a sudden lawsuit. I mean, just about anything will happen. Doing that is part of good planning. So the do side of it is, okay, not only do you look at the downside possibilities in advance, and you're always monitoring your actual performance, we'll come back to that later, but you got to develop fallback plans in simple sketch form if some of these bad things happen. It's just part of planning, and all too often people don't do it.
Worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario, and how will you respond to it? Now, a lot of people say, I don't have the time, or we don't want to go there, right? Who wants to, before they go to bed at night, plan on your nightmares,
right?
And how are you going to deal with it?
Negatively right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Maybe you give up your plan altogether. You give up your hope, your dream.
And, you know, there are other cultures in the world that do this all the time. I think of Germans and Finns and others who are kind of notorious for saying, well, what about the downside? And what if this doesn't work? What if that doesn't work? And they have no nervousness about being negative. Negativity is just part of life. Whereas I think here in the United States, increasingly we've developed more of an allergy to it. You can see it in the schools at all levels, but you can see it in business, that there's a hesitancy to say, this is bad and it's not working and we have to do these things in order to avoid it. We try to avoid it, but we can't. It's just a good thing. And then part of that, part of this about doing fallback plans, there's in planning, poor planning, there's a failure to look at industry norms. And this gets back to our buddy, the gross margin. Say you're in a new venture or you're in an established business and you want to do something new, add a new service. With a bit of simple research, and you can draw on trade journals and annual reports and other things. And if you don't have access to a university library, you can go to the public library, and a lot of the times they have subscriptions to some of these journals. And then I'm sure, you know, there's online, everything, you can get everything online, but those services for that kind of business information are not free. But you should find out if the business you want to go into, what those gross margins are. Is it more like a 30% gross margin or 55? Or is it actually like, are the top dogs, are they pulling in 4 or 5% net income, like at the end of the game, like after all the expenses have been taken out? So you got to, you know, you shouldn't say, I'm going to get this gross margin without really seeing what's normal in the business. And you can't really hope on a kind of pre-tax net income, a final income of your profits, what's left over after you've paid for cost of goods sold and paid for all the expenses. You shouldn't plan on a 15% profit if the industry norm is closer to 2 or 3.
Right. You mentioned journals, and I think also of going to individuals who are in that area business. The only drawback I see of that is maybe the person from whom you would like advice will consider you to be a competitor, and I don't need competitors, so I'm not going to give advice.
True, exactly. And that's part of good research, and we'll get back to that one at Embrace Research Drudgery, that one's coming. Yeah, you got to talk to people. But you're right, it's hard to establish that rapport if the person you're going to talk to is going to be one of your competitors. That's a sensitive kind of issue, and maybe that person won't even want to talk to you. But yeah, just getting that information, finding out, do the legwork. That's the do side of this.
Would you suggest a person wanting to start a business or improve the business going to conferences around the country? Are there such?
Yeah, there are. In Europe they call them trade fairs, but here there's conferences, there's trade conferences, but a lot of times those are expensive. Now, if you don't show there, if you just want to float in and talk to a lot of people, that's where they're all concentrated. That's actually a great suggestion about how to get yourself in a place where there are a lot of people.
Now, on to the next problem, the shoot for the moon problem. Mm-hmm. This sounds as if your goal is out of reach.
In a number of ways, right? Shoot for the moon. A new venture or a new kind of direction business, your most precious resource is talent and doing something very well. If you want to break into the market, you need to break in well. And if it's new, if you're kind of putting things together from scratch, that's really hard. But if you want to tackle 2, 3, 4, 5 new things all at once in your brilliant business gesture, venture, you're asking for mediocrity. You're asking for spreading your talent resources thin. You got to – so that's the don't. Don't even do that. And that's the first part of Shoot the Moon. You got to carefully sort through the opportunities before you even get going. And, of course, you got to do that research, focus on the marketplace, focus on the competition, and then pick – especially if you're really new, pick one thing. Look at the best strategic option you see, the best opportunity, and then you just go for it on that one, and you don't try to draw on a whole lot of other elements. You know, back to our hot dog thing. If you're going to do hot dogs, do them really well. Don't go into porter steaks. I mean, don't even go there. That's a totally different kind of thing. And don't go into Cinnabons, or I'm sorry, that's a brand name. Don't go into bakery. I mean, just don't do that. Really, really stick with one thing.
There are giant corporations that start off, let's say, producing oil, And then they get off into other products that have nothing to do with the production of oil. And pretty soon you have 5 or 6 or 7 different areas, and they just grow and grow, and a lot of times they have to divest.
You're absolutely right. And that, you know, that pulls us into the big companies. And of course, most of business writing focuses on the big companies, and some as, I'll say, a short-term, I'm thinking short-term, maybe they're thinking long-term strategy, will acquire companies, whether they're related to things or not. They're not. You know, there's this French water company that bought a Hollywood studio and other things. But sometimes maybe they're just going for quick financial gain with that. But there are challenges to running a conglomerate. And the less the different elements have to do with each other, the more unruly the whole thing is. It's like building an octopus. When you don't, you want to build something that works. Okay, the B side of the shoot for the moon has to do with just getting it going, especially for new ventures. So they're thinking, all right, we have a new venture, we're doing this. Let's get new furniture. Let's get brand new equipment. Uh-huh. And actually, all of our people, let's get them salaries at the jobs they just left. Right at that level. No one should take a cut for anything. Right, we have total revenues minus the cost of goods sold, your gross margin. And then those expenses, if you lack the cash at the end of the day, you're dead. That lack of cash is dead. Think of a business like a body, and think really of cash as the blood. Cash has to move through the business. If it gets stuck somewhere, I don't want to pursue this metaphor too far, but if you start to hemorrhage, you're dead. You're dead in the water. You need this stuff. So entrepreneurs should be scrappy. Be cheapskates. Why buy that equipment? See if you can lease it. See if you can rent it. Brand new furniture? I don't think so. For what? To just eat potato chips on? Don't even do that. See if you can talk to your people and say, how about for our first period of time, we all take a lower salary? We need to succeed in this together. Some of the best people at this can spend a buck in 5 places. So avoiding luxurious delusions and irrational exuberance with expenses, that's crucial for having some money left over at the end of the month. So that's the other side of the shoot for the moon problem.
Right. There are certain businesses that would want to have a lobby area, really nice appointments for the desk, for the lighting, and all those things, and maybe that's an example of shooting farther than you really need to, or does that attract customers?
It really can. I mean, I'm just thinking the businesses I've seen here in the Lehigh Valley versus those, say, in my homeland, the San Francisco Bay Area. There, that place is so awash in billions, hundreds of billions of venture capital. I've been in a couple of these businesses where they're not making a dime. They're not making a dime, but they're funded by millions put behind them. Because they have this huge cash padding, they're supposed to look like a mature, established business from the start. So they have good digs, and they have receptionists, and they have catered lunches for people, and everyone's supposed to perform tops from the very beginning. And of course, the strategy is to put together a business that will be a killer within 3 quarters. Or they'll take that market share, and then they'll really grow it, and they have pressure from these venture capitalists, but also a lot of support. So yeah, there can be an argument for doing that, but in many cases, it's just ego padding, and it's a waste of cash.
Cosmetic and really doesn't help the business.
Right, right.
Now you mentioned
Botox in the wrong place. Maybe I shouldn't have said yeah. That. Is that not PC? Sorry.
You mentioned short-term and long-term planning. Well, what's the timeline for in business terms? Short-term means about how long, and then long-term.
Well, you know, when you budget, you should budget for the year. But you're not going to know, especially when you're a small venture, how you're going to be doing. You don't have clients locked in place with contracts. The quarter is kind of the established norm for a short term. But you got to know, especially if you're new, or especially if you're trying something new and different, you got to know what's going to happen from month to month. So with the approach of each month, you should know, you should do your best to forecast pretty as accurate as you can the next month so that you don't run into a trouble. But of course, by the end of the quarter, maybe not quite as accurate. The next quarter, less accurate. Because things are changing so fast, to speak about planning where you want to be in 5 years is kind of fantasy land, especially if it's for a small business. But if you're a well-established small business and you have that base that you can draw on and you think about going in a new direction, why not? Why not do that longer-term planning, especially when you're the smaller business owner and you're thinking about maybe succession issues? You know, there's a life cycle to the business as there are life cycles to people. So I can't really give you a straight answer, but it depends entirely on the business. Well, how about we say that?
Yeah, if a business has been going well for 20 or 30 years, then they can afford better to look at the 5-year plan, the 10-year plan.
If they're doing well now, that's the other thing. Who cares if you have 20 or 30 years behind you if you're on shifting sand? And if you ever make the mistake, maybe we'll get to this later on, of thinking, I've been in the business for 20, 30 years. I can't mess it up. Oh, you just wait. It's like driving a car. I don't care how old and how rich or how expensive your car is. You take your hands off the wheel and you look out the other window to the right or the left. You're going to be up a tree.
All right. Dr. Brennan Purcell is my guest this evening. He teaches at DeSales University. And we're talking about business history lessons, small businesses, business do's and don'ts. So far, we have talked about different problems that Dr. Purcell brings to us. There's the one called Even Steven and the oversized customer, the priced to die problem, and poor planning. Then shoot for the moon. When we come back from our break, which is coming up, we're going to talk about the problem called death by litigation. Oh, we are a litigious society.
Yes, we are.
This item has to come up in your presentation because...
Listeners, you should see John. He's just shaking his head. Crestfallen, shaking his head.
I'm trembling. About litigation.
Yeah, it's bad.
So we will talk about that when we come back. You're listening to WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Time to take another break and stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Dr. Brennan Purcell is pursuing the topic this evening of small business do's and don'ts. Brennan, it's clear what you mean by death by litigation, but tell us how to avoid this one. Do you have to have your own army of lawyers?
Oh, that's what you want to avoid, but you have to have good relations with a lawyer to draw on. Should it come this far? Yes, we live in a terribly litigious society. I don't know if this is true anymore, John. Have you heard this? That some like 50% of the world's lawyers live in the United States.
I had never heard that.
I've heard that claimed. There's other jokes about lawyers belonging at the bottom of the sea, but we're not going to repeat those now. No, sorry. There's a lot of litigation going on, and it's just a fact of life. There's a lot of small business litigation. But the problem is once one of these things gets going, it takes on a life of its own, and it just drains the business of money. It drains the leaders of their energy. It's emotionally straining. It's stressful as anything. It's distracting, and it's so easy once one of these things begin to kick the can down the road and appeal it here and go there and get this kind of injunction, that kind of thing. It's terrible what's out there. So. Okay, you want to avoid it as much as possible. So this is just what I've gathered, that the vast majority of the time, it's better just to take it in the teeth and try to settle out of court and try to get the person or entity with which you have that conflict to get an arbitrator, one established within the business sector, to get a kind of settlement even before, if you can stay out of court. And if you are dragged into court, please try to keep the conversation. We want to settle this. We want to settle this equitably. I know I have a recent case of an organization that tore itself to shreds over this. And I remember hearing the judge's quote, this is a sad day for this organization. And saying, I recommend a settlement. And it just went on and went on. And by the end, the organization had torn itself to shreds. And there was nothing left for anybody. So if you don't believe what I'm saying, talk to people who have been through this. And I'm sure it'll be easy to find them. But yeah, there's enough problems in business. The last thing you want is litigation. But I think every business person needs to have a good lawyer behind them that they can, someone they trust and someone they can draw on, because frivolous lawsuits pop up. I think the most glaring one I heard the other day was from an employee who sued the company for having improperly poured parking lot because there are too many puddles in the parking lot.
Oh,
and
wow.
It got the shoes too wet.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to believe these kinds of things, but they happen. They happen.
Yes, and the expression, oh, you could just sue them, is just so common.
It's a problem.
That's the death by litigation problem. What about why should small businesses and startups embrace research drudgery?
All right. Okay. It may feel like drudgery, but this kind of draws together all the stuff that we were talking about earlier. There's four parts to this one. First one, market research. If you're going to be doing something new, or even while you're doing this, while you're in an established business, you got to get out into the marketplace and you got to talk to a lot of people. You mentioned the trade conference. Absolutely. Should never commit to a new product or service strategy until consulting potential customers about what they want. There's been people who talk about talk to 100 customers in the first 10 days. See if you can do 10 a day, because then you'll kind of know what you want. It may seem like drudgery, but the value is almost inestimable.
Now, when you talk to people about potential consumers, what they might like in either product or service, do you simply ask the question, would you like to have a sponge that is this big and that absorbs more quickly than any sponge you've ever used before? Or do you present the product to the person to feel it, to handle it?
That depends on the product or the service that you're offering, right? I mean, I know this guy is an entrepreneur in Jersey, and he sells medical equipment to surgeons. And the way he makes that sale is you must get it into their hands. They're surgeons. You can't just tell them about it, and you can't just show them pictures. You have to get it into their hands. And he says you see them, they kind of feel it and turn it over. So it depends on the product. And that gets to the portion of this embrace research drudgery. You have to get the reason for the customer to change, because chances are you're not going to do something wildly new. You'll be going to a competitive area. You need to put together something called a competitive matrix, in which you lay it out. What are the different competitors? What are they offering? What are the major factors that your buyers, that your customers are going to consider making that decision? And you have to persuade yourself as well as your test customers. If you can't reach a conclusion that anybody would be crazy not to try or go with your product, then a buyer won't think that way either. You know, you have to persuade yourself and you have to persuade others. And then there's it's called the value add. You have to make the value add. If you go with my product or my service, you're getting this much more value out of it than the competition. You have to be able to understand that and demonstrate that, not only in terms of the qualities of the product and also the aspects of the service, but in terms of the financial side. If you spend this amount of money on my service here, it'll save you that much later. And you can't just say it. You really got to calculate it. If you're really claiming that if you go with me with this and not with the customers, you'll pay this, but you'll end up saving this from that and that and that, you got to spell it out, because any good kind of rational customer will be thinking, oh, he says I'm going to save money, but what? They haven't thought it through. You need to think it through for them. You have to be able to show what you claim in terms of a financial payback.
And for a presentation like that, would you suggest having something in writing that the person actually sees?
Yes.
How about PowerPoint presentations? Do they work? Are they burdensome?
There's death by PowerPoint that happens all the time. But for a financial calculation, you've got to show it. You've got to show it, and we've got to show the numbers, and don't make it complicated. But you really got to show this expense here, if on this product, will get you this return in these ways, and then you put a dollar value on them. And then the other main part of this embrace research drudgery has to do with finding the segment. Do you like playing with dice?
Do I like playing with dice?
There's this great game called the Dice Game. I'll show you sometime. It's so much fun. But I just want to use the example of dice, and I'm going to put a fake number on it. Say that the world market for dice, all the dice consumed across the entire world, is like $10 million. Right? Dice are cheap, right? Maybe it isn't even $10 million, but whatever. All right. Say you think, I'm gonna figure out this way to use this material and this simple machining, and we can do it in my garage, about making a dice that people want to hold. And the people, they make a certain kind of sound when it clinks and when you move it in your hands, right? Yeah. Do that. It feels good. And we're going to do this and say, all right, so it's 10 million. You've looked it up, 10 million in the world. All right, I can get in and do 5%. Really? Well, hold on. Do some market research, especially checking out the segment. What if you looked a little deeper into it? You find that 60% of all dice made, I'm making this up, are done for the people who make, you know, the companies like Mattel and whatever that make the games that have dice already included in them. Oh, 60%. So 6 million, poof, is gone. And then you find that another 15 million, or let's say 20 million, is dice going to big casinos. And there's only like one or two suppliers for each of these guys. And so those are kind of dominated right there. And how could you break into that? When you look at it closer, maybe your $10 million market has shrunk to about two. Did I do 60 plus 20? Yeah, all right. Shrunk to about two. Now, can you get 5% of that? Probably, if that's just the random dice left over for the people who like to buy dice because they like playing the dice game and giving the dice to their friends. But it's only 2 million, and if you got to 5% of that, would that be enough for you to cover your costs? Maybe not. So you got to pay attention to segmenting as you do your research.
Good points here.
It's drudgery, but you got to do it. You got to embrace it.
But I know that you, being in academe, do not consider research and drudgery in the same sentence.
Well, there are some drag parts of it. Come on, there really are. But look, yeah, you're right. In academe, we love solving problems. We love getting the question. Oh, that's fun.
And the other part of that is when you're doing research, you have to be patient.
Yes.
Because it might take you months to get to the result that you want. And when we're talking about business, we don't want to spend time like that.
Right. Who has time? Everything is now. That's what's the great fun, really stimulating thing about business. Everything is now. You can't be leisurely about these things. You really can't. You can't like, oh, this will be a longer work. And then she's just kind of, you know, right? You know colleagues who have talked like that.
Goes into his British accent.
Oh, sorry. I just, those are the ones
that's a little tease. That's all.
Yeah, sure. Why not? That's what they're there for.
Well, what are you thinking of when you say stare truth in the face?
Okay. Stare truth in the face. There's four parts of this one. The first part, be ready to admit failure when it hits you. Just be ready. Because as said, 80% of all new products they get launched fail. And probably the same 80-20 rule applies to new businesses and new ventures. Look, if none of your targets, at a certain point, if none of your planned targets have been met, if your financial exposure is only getting worse, and you're launching a new segment of your business, a new area, if that financial exposure starts to endanger the rest of the business, wake up. And also, if the cash, if the capital you've brought together for this venture is gone, you have to ask this question. It's a really important question. Would we invest the needed funds in this project today if it was presented to us as a fresh opportunity? To try to let go of all the assumptions and everything you poured into it, look at it in the face and say, knowing what we know today, would we spend it on it today? And if you can't say yes, be ready to go to those fallback plans. part B. Are we ready to go into B? And I'm trying to monitor the time. Sure. I don't want to run over time. Just want to do this right. Okay, for part B, this is the danger of success. Be ready. Stare truth in the face. Be ready to admit when you've lost control. I know some people who are running a small business over in Germany, and they have a subsidiary here in the United States. They're growing at 20% a year. And when the guy told me, he blinked repeatedly, and he wasn't grinning. And I said, ja, das ist eine Herausforderung. That's a challenge. He said, it is. It's driving us nuts. It's conceivable, and it happens. You can succeed your way into bankruptcy. It is easy to lose control of things. Maybe hiring, maybe you're behind on it, and then you get ahead on it. Your customer service might go down the tubes when you're growing out of control. What about quality controls? It is possible to lose control, and admit it when you don't know how you're doing. If you don't know financially where you are, then your financial controls are out of control. If your reports about quality, you're just getting waves of reports about people complaining and you don't know why. If you say, but look at our top line, look at the revenues, it keeps going up and it keeps going up. But if you feel like your business, if the cost of goods sold, if supplying those goods and those services are out of control, or God help you, the expenses, if you've gotten a fleet of company cars and you don't even know where they are, you are out of control. So you've got to take a step back and look at things very objectively and admit it, I've lost control.
Now, that kind of point, I think, would be applicable to huge businesses as well as tiny businesses.
Yes, and the bigger they are, the harder it's ever to know what's going on, the more you rely on reporting. But yeah, especially that's why we're mainly talking about small businesses and entrepreneurs, because there's a lot of small businesses here in the Lehigh Valley. I mean, a lot. There are hundreds of them. You know, the press pays attention to the big ones, but it's really in this local economy we have here, it's a lot of small business. All right, the third part of this one is accept change when it happens. It changes all the time, and the pace is going crazy. It's wild. You have to stare truth in the face and accept change when it happens. There's a famous story about a small business that made really good teddy bears in the United States, and they just turned up their nose at all this outsourcing and overseas manufacturing. They wouldn't open up a subsidiary in China. They just wouldn't do it. And guess what? People, just their price, they kept their prices, and then their competitors, their prices were falling. And they said, well, we are America. We're going to stay working in the United States. And so they tried to counteract that. Here was their strategy. Let's cheapen the line. Let's go with this kind of stuffing. It doesn't feel quite as huggable as the other one did. Let's go with this kind of supply. Let's see if we can make it cheaper. Let's see if we can just, you know, reduce the quality marginally.
Just to compete.
And they found that what they did is they basically gave customers more reason not to buy it. So the price stayed the same, and they cheapened the line, and then they lowered the price. And by that time, people were done with it anyway. They died. There's a firm in Germany that claims to make the original teddy bear. Yeah. And they're still doing okay. Why? Because the way they've marketed and positioned themselves, we're the original. We're all about quality, and we have this and we have that. And they talk about all the qualities of the teddy bear that make this just an incredible teddy bear. And so it's like a high-end teddy bear. But they've also, yes, they produce some in Germany, but the vast majority are produced somewhere else. But they've insisted on German design and German quality, and they have hung in there. So the main point with this is when change is happening, you have to see and you have to accept it. You can't say, but we've always been this good, or but we have to do this. You're just staying with the same game plan isn't going to win the game when the rules change on you. And then finally, the fourth part of this, how are we doing on time? Are we all right?
Fine.
We're all right? Okay. You got to know the return of every cost. And you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? You have to, as a small business owner or manager, entrepreneur, you have to know, what are we spending money on? And what are we getting out of it? Are we getting back what we should? You will be besieged by vendors saying, you really need this new computer system because this will help speed up that amount of time, this amount of time, and you can reduce the expenses of the bookkeeper, and this thing is the greatest thing. Well, it comes at a cost. Do you really need to hire these people to manage this side of the business or that? Yes, maybe you do, but you also have to know what you're getting back. Many of the expenses are, as I said, they're important. They're not really frivolous, but you got to know. And if you see the costs kind of running out of control, it's really important to develop those, as we said before, those fallback plans, right? If you have the sense you're running out of control and that the things you're identifying as high costs and you don't see the value, the worth of it, then you need to say, all right, we're going down this channel. I need to do the fallback, the cutback plan. Maybe you should have a kind of knee-jerk cutback plan where you've identified the fat and you know, okay, when this is happening, I'm going to trim it for this good reason. And all these things we've been talking about, John, they all have to do with this final line about staring truth in the face. It's too easy to bring this all around, to be over-optimistic and say, things will change to my favor. And to be sunny and say things are great or will get better when maybe all the signs are that you're either succeeding yourself out of control or you're spending yourself into the ground or the landscape is changing on you or anything else that can kind of upset a business.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Brennan Purcell. And guess what? Our time is up.
Oh, that went by fast.
You timed everything that you wanted to say just perfectly.
Oh, thanks, John.
Dr. Purcell is a professor and consultant at DeSales University. He teaches and researches history and business, a very interesting combination. I take it that the consultant part of what you do is with small businesses.
Yes.
So there are people like you that people wanting to start a small business can turn to and get some advice on how do we figure all of these different questions out.
Yeah. Yep, that's right.
Dr. Brennan Purcell, thank you so much for coming back to our microphones here at WDIY.
You're welcome, John.
Thanks to Neil Heaver for being our engineer this evening. I'm John Pierce. Looking forward to having you listen to us in the future with Lehigh Valley Discourse. And remember, until we meet again, to be gentle with your neighbor.